which will bring us forward to returning to our open session agenda, item five, which is a review of the real estate investment performance and pacing recommendation. Did you have any preliminary comments, Tim, or were you going to turn it over to Scott?
I was going to turn it over to Scott pretty quickly here, but just a little bit of a recap for the board. This is our once a year review where we get into private markets and we do a little bit of a deeper dive. Private markets, as we all recall, these are typically 10-year lockup period vehicles. We measure these on an IRR basis and multiple of capital, so it's a little bit different performance measurement. So we do it on a little bit less frequent basis to take a look at the cash flows there. I would say just the caveat is it's been a difficult period for real estate. We've all seen the headlines. We've seen certainly what's going on in the office space. Through the past 10 years or so, we went from high prices in real estate to weak fundamentals going into COVID to high borrowing costs as rates went up. So there's been a lot of headwinds. I think anecdotally with last week's 50 basis point Fed cut, we're hearing from real estate managers that there seems to be an impetus to get the ball rolling. So in the past couple of years, most of the sales we've seen have been distressed sales. So we all see the headlines where an office building is selling at a huge discount to its last trade. Those are very distressed markets. I think kind of going forward basis, we're looking at more performing assets starting to trade. So what you're going to see here takes a look at where we've been, the effects of COVID, the effects of higher interest rates and the headwinds there. I just wanted to offer a little caveat that with rate cuts, we are hearing buzzing from the real estate community. We'll see if that's backed up with actual transaction volume over the next couple of quarters. But with that, I'll turn it over to Scott.
Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Nice to see you all. So we do this annually. We have three primary objectives. Danny is going to be helping me out today with the first one, which is really to give you a sense of the market environment that we're operating in, go into a little bit more detail of the broad comments that Tim just made, talk to you about where your portfolio is today in terms of positioning, both from an asset type perspective and also from a vintage year perspective, and then a forecasted or forward look on our recommendations in terms of pacing and investments going forward and what type of investments to make. So it follows along in our table of contents. We meet those objectives sort of through the structure of the document and the comments that we're going to make. And with that, I will turn it over to Danny to give you a brief review of the market environment.
Excellent. Thank you, Scott. Welcome back. Good morning, Danny. Nice to have you back.
All right, thank you. I was going to dive into the performance section there. All right. So the theme that you'll see here, as Scott alluded to, is we'll review kind of where we've been. We'll talk a little bit about where we're at and then where we're going. So since late 2022, core real estate has experienced six consecutive quarters of write-downs. So this has been a really painful place to be. In 2023, every core sector was negative. And if you look at the chart on the bottom right there, we go over these different core sectors. So apartment, industrial, office, and retail. Office was down 17.6. Scott's going to go into this a little bit more in his section. Retail was down about 1%. So every sector has been a painful area to be in. So that's really the negative here with the performance. I think the positive is if we look back at these periods where we have distress in markets, if we go back to the tech crash in the early 2000s, if we go back to the great financial crisis, 07, 09, the real estate vintages that came out of those years are some of the best that we've seen in the last 30, some of the non-core areas. So these crises create opportunities. Yes, we've been through a really painful time, and we're still going through it. But we do think the outlook here is really positive, especially for some of the opportunistic strategies that you guys should be seeing in your book. If we move on to the fundamentals, generally these have weakened over the last several years. I think two that we can look at here are, do we have people in our properties, vacancy rates, and we can also look at net income growth. So vacancy rates, we've been seeing those have been ticking upward, right? So that's kind of giving us a signal that it's still pretty weak. Net income growth, if we look on the chart on the bottom right, you can see that while that metric has come down, we're still seeing some growth in that space, even including office, even though office has kind of been has been stagnating. And that's one area I really want to jump into on the next slide, is talking about these challenges that we see in the office space. So I think we're mostly aware of this. We've heard about this. We've seen this in the news. But physical occupancy remains at 50% of where it was pre-COVID. So that's pretty alarming to think about, that we only have 50% occupancy of where we were pre-COVID. There's also other things happening here within office. One is we continue to see this bifurcation of the type of office that people are attracted to. So people whose leases are expiring and they're looking to get new properties, or people who are just, new businesses looking to lease out office properties, they're really focusing on the newest and the most attractive office spaces in the space. So some of the older properties, some of the vintages from the 90s or 80s or 70s are significantly less attractive to the people who are coming into the market right now. People are looking for the nicest and the newest.
Just to kind of bring that point home, our LA office, we just moved about a mile and a half up the road to a completely renovated, brand new building, reduced our footprint a little bit, but really upscaled in terms of amenities for less rent. So we got sort of a much nicer property or a much nicer space for less rent. And those are the challenges that building owners are seeing in the office space.
And the other challenge here with office, so you have occupancies at 50%, people are looking for the nicest and newest. And the third one that's really hard to get your arms around is understanding this leasing cycle. So leasing cycle is 5 to 7 years. And if we go back, to COVID, 3 or 4 years is really where we had that start of that impact. We're not going to know the full effects of this for at least another few years. The full effects of COVID on office, particularly, at least for another few years. So that's just something to keep in mind. So those are some of the most challenging parts. I want to move on to fundraising, though, if we can move on to 10.
So
yeah.
On that last point, so the grand celebration of the new lease in January of 2020 is really not yet played out, and it may just be starting in January, right, for a 5.
Yeah.
And it's going to extend on for another 2 years, right?
Yeah. So yeah, if you started in January of 2020, if you entered into a new lease, those people, if they did a 5-year lease, we won't know till 2025, or a 7-year, until 2 years after that.
Yeah, I did that before the .com burst. It had a big signed a new lease just prior to that. So I've seen that movie a little bit, but yeah, okay.
Yeah. So if we move on to fundraising here. So the number of funds closed has really declined substantially over the last year, as well as the amount of capital raised. And we can see that in Contra Costa's book, too. This rhymes with what we actually experienced and saw. So last year when Scott was here, we said we thought that the Contra Costa would commit about $400 million to real estate in 2024. But I think talking with Tim and team, I think it's going to come in closer to 170 for 2024, and it's for good reason. It's because they're not finding good opportunities in the space. So there's fewer funds that are coming available, and even fewer that look good. So I mean, we support obviously, the ones that they're getting into, but the ones that they're excluding are they're trying to find the best in the space. So. We've seen that there here. We've seen fewer funds in this space too, in this portfolio. So the majority, another thing we've seen in the portfolio is the majority of funds that are closing in this space recently are in the opportunistic space. That's a big part of Contra Costa's portfolio, so that rhymes with what we're seeing here. And then the other thing I'd say is, you know, for those investors that are in open-end funds that can get out of these real estate funds in a, you know, on a quarterly or semi-annual basis, we are seeing some pretty large redemptions in that space. Our real estate team is seeing that. And, you know, what we saw is about 17% of NAV of the funds that we surveyed are being redeemed now. And those are really levels that we haven't seen since the GFC. So the redemptions are pretty significant in this space for open-end funds. If we move on to the next slide, real estate debt. So real estate debt's a new asset class that was added to the, or that will be added to the portfolio. Here, I think the message is really what we expect to see going forward. This has really created a unique opportunity in this space. So banks and insurance companies have been exiting some of the lending space. They've been tightening their standards, getting some risk off of their books. But in the development and construction area, that's a unique area where we're going to start hopefully seeing some funds go into that space to raise capital that we can participate in that'll give us some attractive opportunities. So for real estate debt, there's nothing in the portfolio today, but this is an area that we're going to be looking to build out in the next several years. And then I'll just move right on to the outlook summary. So generally our outlook is positive. I think the three areas that I'd focus my attention on here are value add, opportunistic, and real estate debt, the three components that are in Contra Costa's portfolio. Tim kind of alluded to this. In the value add space, one thing that's really important for those funds is the cost of leverage. So those funds are typically employing quite a bit of leverage, and the cost of leverage has been really high recently. The Fed did recently cut interest rates, so that's going to have an impact. That's going to reduce the cost of leverage. If they continue lowering rates, we should see that come down. So that's an optimistic outlook for the future if rates come down. But right now, we remain neutral on value-add real estate. We are positive, however, on opportunistic real estate. So the opportunity that's been created from this rise in interest rates is where opportunistic is going to come into the space and find some really valuable opportunities. So there's pockets of distress that they're going to take advantage of, and we remain positive on that asset class. And then real estate debt, as I said earlier, there's this structural shift that's going away from banks and insurers lending in some areas of the economy where funds are going to be able to come in and provide that private capital, and we'll be able to take advantage of that. So that's what I was going to say on the outlook summary. If there aren't any questions, then I'll pass it on to Scott for the portfolio review.
Any questions on the outlook or the market environment before we move into your portfolio?
And the issue with the REITs is, I mean, from your presentation or your handout, it looked like the public side of it was doing okay compared to the private side. But going forward, your neutral position on REITs is because the risk return makes sense because of the volatility with REITs.
Yeah, so REITs have actually benefited relative to open-end funds in the private space and some closed-end funds because their asset allocations, their positioning is different, right? They're lower in office. They have much more investments in things like, you know, medical buildings, retirement housing, a broader diversification away from office. So they've done better from that perspective because of that. Also, REITs really sort of act in terms of the movement of the asset like a small cap value stock, and equities have done better than real estate just generally. It's a good holding place for you all as you're getting invested into your private markets, but we think over time the asset class really ought to be funded through non-REIT, non-public market investments. Does that make sense?
Okay. Scott?
Yeah, please.
Just one thought. There's, on this next page, I think you're going to be discussing, the, among other things, the private real estate equity and debt, or debt basically. It's zero allocation at this point, and there's a long-term allocation or recommendation for about 3%. It looks to me as if, perhaps not surprisingly, that residential real estate, new homes in particular, are really on the rise. The Toll Brothers and Pulte and Lennar and companies like that, they're building like crazy. And also, as the Fed rate comes down, that's going to be more attractive for new home loans. Does that give us an opportunity to look at?
So the real estate debt that you would likely be playing in is not in the single family residential space that you think of as traditional housing. There may be some opportunities there, but it'll largely be debt to other types of real estate development and investment projects. It could even be funding core funds that have a need for real estate debt where previously they went to banks or insurance companies, but those aren't providing the capital anymore, and you can step in and gain a premium on where the opportunity has been in the past. But I think that single-family residential is probably not a big opportunity set for real estate debt. Hmm.
So we've launched our study of the space. We've identified about seven platforms that we're interested in. Most of these are open-ended funds, which presents a challenge because they have legacy assets, and if those legacy assets are office, we have to factor in a markdown there. Most of what we're doing, looking at on a prospective basis, is whole loans to commercial real estate, either recapitalizing existing properties at reset valuations, or funding construction loans. That looks like where the most robust activity is right now. Anything in the single family space is usually expressed more through RMBS securities, not whole loans. So that's kind of the bifurcation there.
Okay, thanks.
So if you look at slide 16 and talking, sort of following up on some of the comments that Danny just made, you can see where the portfolio is moving into. So that private real estate equity, value add and opportunistic with a slant towards opportunistic, not core properties. And then the real estate debt, as we talked about, and thanks for the question, just had an opportunity to expand on that, is going to be a new allocation where we think opportunity is being presented because of the way the market is shifting and current and past providers moving out and providing more opportunity for private capital like yourselves. So you can see how the current allocation moving away from that holding place in REITs into private real estate equity, and we'll talk about the timing of that, and then moving into real estate debt, hopefully quickly, fairly quickly, with the idea of moving into open-ended funds rather than closed-end funds. So let's talk about the real estate program as it currently exists. You can see the big pie chart on the left is pretty straightforward. It just shows that your current allocation to private real estate at 5.1%, growing up towards that 10%, including real estate debt. We'll talk about the timing of that when we get to the pacing slides in a few slides. And then the charts on the right give you sort of a sense of how your real estate program has evolved. You can see that the allocation value has steadily declined as a percentage of commitments and as a percentage of the total fund, as the asset class hasn't kept up with other parts of the portfolio, as Danny alluded to during the historic asset class performance discussion, particularly as strong equity performance has driven portfolio gains for quite some time. And then in dollar terms, the chart on the lower right-hand portion of the page. This is a good chart to get a sense of the commitment history and the net asset value in the asset class. You can see the building of the program prior to 2015 and then basically a steady state as commitments was about equal to funds rolling out of the program, and then through COVID as activity came to a stop, and finally an uptick as the program has recently restarted. This eye chart just is pulled from your quarterly performance report. It really just shows all the details that, and you know, you can take a look at this at your leisure to get a sense of all the funds, where they are from the commitment level, how much has been called, and then some performance metrics around the total value to paid in capital and the distributions to paid in capital. We're going to go through this in a little bit more detail momentarily, but this is just a chart that you can take a look at to get a good sense of where you are overall. Before we get into performance broadly, let's talk about program diversification. By manager, the chart on the upper left-hand portion of the page, it just is what it is, not particularly informative. But by geography and strategy, you can see that you are largely positioned in the U.S. More than three-quarters of the portfolio is U.S.-based with some international holdings in some of the funds. And then roughly evenly split between value add and opportunistic, the chart on the upper right-hand portion of the page. That will continue with a little bit more of a tilt towards opportunistic. And then by property type diversification, office has been coming down. You can see the chart on the lower left-hand portion of the page. The blue bars relative to the NCREIF index, which is, you know, we think of as sort of the passive or index investment. You can see office has been coming down where it's underweight relative to the benchmark today, residential higher, industrial higher. And then vintage year diversification, an important point there. We like to, if possible, keep sort of vintage year diversification fairly steady. You can see through time there have been a couple of years or a couple of periods where it doesn't show up in terms of commitments. This is for a couple of reasons. One is that that gap in 2016 and 17, the vintage year investments came late in that 2015 year, so it really sort of bled into 16 and 17, so a little bit of a just a data misrepresentation there. And then the 20 and 21 was intentional, as at, following COVID, you know, there was an intentional effort to just kind of wait and see how things played out. And also, the opportunities through that period were literally or virtually non-existent. So other than that, you have relatively good vintage year diversification. We talk about now moving into a period where the market has been challenged, and these vintage years and the commitments that we make now likely providing good results going forward.
Scott, before you leave that,
yeah,
I may be mixing up a presentation versus a commitment we made, but I thought we had some exposure to student housing. But this shows we do not.
This is the current exposure. So any commitments we've made that have not yet been deployed don't show up here. This is what's actually been deployed.
So we have made or we'll likely make a commitment to student housing.
We have made a commitment to a fund where student housing is a component.
Right.
Nothing on a dedicated basis, but it was a component of a broader fund.
Okay. Thanks.
Good memory there, and that should show up in future charts in future presentations. Okay, so this next slide is interesting, and I think the red jumps out at you, and that's really the point of this slide. We are showing here how the commitment or the investments in office has really sort of declined over time, but has also had a big impact on the portfolio up to this point, right? So you saw in the chart that Danny showed back on slide five how office has really just taken in the teeth that you all know and understand intuitively. You can see the investments in some of these older dated funds had a significant portion of office in them. The orange line shows the break between before pre-COVID commitments and after COVID commitments, and you can see that since COVID, both in your value-add funds and your opportunistic funds, there's been virtually no or very low commitments and investments in office. You may see that actually starting to ramp up as potential opportunities in office come available, and we evaluate and make determinations as to whether or not to invest in those currently or going forward.
And just a little bit of a history lesson here. For those trustees who are around in the 2009 and 10 period, you'll recall that we did a lot in office right then because we had fully occupied buildings with distressed owners. Obviously, now you have distressed buildings and distressed owners. We need to see one of those have a positive trend before we get interested in office again. So, unfortunately, until we get clarity on how many Americans are going to work in offices on a regular basis, that's going to be a light exposure for us.
It's a very uncertain time, it seems, on that. The effect that the pandemic has had, I know I'm just stating the obvious, but the effect on the workplace, literally how we function day to day, is remarkable. It's extraordinary.
Yeah, the workplace, obviously, eviction moratoriums on multifamily had a big impact during COVID. That's the after effects that's still filtering out here. So I think this has been, you can see that there's been a concerted effort to tilt the portfolio towards some of these alternative sectors that have been under-owned by institutions historically, but might have a differentiated revenue base that is a little bit more durable and a little bit less levered. And so we've done more in the hospitality space post-COVID. We've done more in the single family for rent space. It's just been a concerted effort to say, we have a legacy exposure to office. We don't yet have clarity. What else can we build into in this period?
Yeah, looking at this chart, one of the very first things I voted on, I was appointed in 2013, was the Sigurd Ree Gough Distressed Real Estate Fund II, which had a slug of office in it. But I can remember that, and I remember the discussion at the time. At least some of the discussion I had with the presenters was 4 years plus after the GFC. There was still a pretty heavy appetite in the distressed, yeah, you know, market space, right? So, to your point earlier, Danny, I mean, the situation we're in now, I don't know how to handicap the timeline of that. I really don't. It's really uncertain.
Howard Marks had a really good quote. Howard Marks, the head of Oak Tree Capital, I had a quote earlier this year. He said, you know, in 10 years' time, if you take two investments, one in core office downtown and one in suburban office in a tertiary market, one of those is going to be lights out better than the other one. I have no idea which one it's going to be. So,
statement on the benefits of diversification.
Yep.
Okay, so the next couple of slides, a little less of an eye chart than the previous chart that I showed, and shows really, if you just kind of scan the numbers, this is value add. The next one I'll show and make a couple of more detailed comments on is for the opportunistic part of the portfolio. You know, largely in line, some underperformance, and then the most recent one starting in 2022, really too early to tell, right? So, legacy portfolio, you know, I would say slightly disappointing, but largely in line in the value add space, largely for some of the reasons that we've been talking about. On this next page, the opportunistic page, a little bit more.
Scott, real quick, I'm sorry. So the net IRR comparisons.
Yeah.
We're below the median just about every time except for 2015 and 2019.
Yeah, and so your legacy funds below the median. The one disappointment there is the LaSalle fund. Just a fund that disappointed on their performance. Not great explanations as to why on the individual fund performance, just sort of median to below median on the legacy funds.
Okay.
Largely managers and funds that we won't be investing with going forward.
Okay.
And then on the opportunistic, on the next slide, a little bit more to talk about here. Again, if you look down the net IRR, the TVPI, the total value to paid in capital, sort of, again, around median peer, but slightly below on average. And then a couple of things to point out here. That DLJ Fund 6 down the bottom is definitely an outlier that stands out. You know, that was a smallish fund with a small number of investments. And their first investment makes up half the value of the fund. It's about a $100 million fund, $97 million fund, $46 million in that first investment that they made back in 2018, right before COVID. This was a multifamily investment where the thesis was it was a building converted to multifamily illegally, right? And they were going to come in and they were going to make everything right and whole and change the tenants out, increase the rents, and make it a proper multifamily property. That was the theme. That was the thesis. Well, then COVID hit, as Tim mentioned, multifamily building evictions, you couldn't do them, and so the thesis blew up. So they had to pay more to get people out. Some people just didn't want to leave, weren't gonna take advantage of the payouts, and the building went from $46 million to $12.7 million, which they marked it down to in one of the big main properties, the first property in a fund with fewer properties. And it just had a huge impact on the overall IRR of the fund. So one building, one mistake because of COVID really sunk that one fund. If you look through the other DLJ funds, not huge performance there as well. So again, similar to value add, sort of culling some of the managers of the past that haven't performed as expected. A couple other points, if you look at the Oak Tree fund there, 10% IRR relative to the median peer. Those TVPI numbers and the TVPI of 0.7 is actually 1.3, so right on top of the median peer there. And the DPI of 0.7, those numbers just needed to be updated. And so you can see there that Oak Tree Fund is performing well, in line or a little bit better than peers. And then that Cross Lake Fund, the most recent fund that's been committed to, that TVPI number of 0.2 stands out, but there's good reason for that. That's there's only been a little bit of the commitment that's been drawn. You guys were one of the early investors in that fund, so all the fees that are coming in are basically being allocated to you guys. Those fees will be reimbursed to the tune right now of about $450,000, which will bring that, just by virtue of the math, will bring that TVPI up to about a 0.7. So the Cross Lake Fund still have real good expectations for
it. Hey, so, Scott, before you leave this topic, the DOJ Fund 6, without getting too granular here in this meeting, is that particular property located south of us by about 350 miles, or am I thinking of another one?
I think that it's a property in Brooklyn.
Okay. Yeah. All right.
The one south of us is still in an earlier fund, still operating.
I thought it might have been. I'd seen it recently. I think I shared with you, and so I was trying to understand that. Okay.
Yeah. So, you know, I would put the performance characteristics at sort of expectations are a little bit below for the older fund, for the older vintage funds. Still have high expectations for the funds that have been invested in since COVID, and the opportunities going forward look very strong. So with
new funds or for performance?
New funds. Yeah. So moving to pacing and starting to think a little bit about forecasting out. 24 and slides 24 and 25, a lot of detail. It's really just all the backbone analytics that go into what we think we ought to be doing on an annual basis to make sure we meet that target in a reasonable period of time, at a pace that is achievable. And really we get to slide 26, which sort of wraps this all up. You can see the total commitments out through 2030 is in the $300 to $400 million range, with $300 to $400 million range when you include real estate debt. And we're talking about, again, very similar to our expectations for last year, 3 to 5 funds a year, which ought to get you fully funded up to that 10%, getting close, you know, out 4 or 5 years, but reaching your target of 10% out in 2030. And so our recommendation, moving to the next and last slide, is to keep that pace moving forward as market opportunities present themselves. As Danny mentioned, the opportunity set was a little slimmer than we had hoped in 2024, but assuming the market opportunity set continues to present itself, getting $300 to $400 million invested or committed, I should say, per year, 3 to 5 funds across both equity and real estate debt. And we'll be looking for those specialty funds with more diverse real estate types, looking at distressed, and then, of course, looking at the real estate debt funds. And I'll open it up for questions. Otherwise, that concludes our prepared remarks.
All right, thank you, Scott. On real estate debt, how long are those funds locked up typically?
So there's open-end fund opportunities in real estate debt, which means that they're evergreen funds. The closed-end funds are shorter-lived than real estate equity closed-end funds. And I'm not sure of the split between open-end and closed-end that you guys are thinking about, but I think that they're looking at those open-end evergreen funds to get up to speed quicker.
So you could move in and out if you need to.
So the focus initially is on the open-end funds. We're open to closed-end funds when there's a compelling opportunity. I think right now, as the market's still evolving, we want to be exposed to where the rates are right now. With the closed-end funds, they typically have 2 to 3 year investment periods and 3 year harvest periods, so they're much shorter than a private equity fund, but still, I think there's an opportunity today. And if rates are come down 100 basis points over the next year, we'd rather be earlier on that cycle. So that's the initial focus is open-ended.
Okay. To Tim's earlier point, just want to reiterate, you know, a lot of those closed-end funds are slow to take marks as the market moves against them, as long as they think they're going to get paid back, right? So you don't want to be buying into an open-end fund where the value of the debt has dropped because of credit quality or for whatever reason. And so you just need to be careful as you underwrite these open-end funds that you're not buying in at marks that are higher than what the market would normally put.
Scott, could you give us an idea, just an example or two, of what a non-traditional sector might be?
Medical office. Senior housing, open-air storage facilities.
Open-air storage facilities?
So, yeah, where you go and you
park. I mean, no roofs or what?
Yeah, it's basically dirt lots where you go and you park trucks or...
campers.
Yeah,
or boats.
Big shipping containers. data centers. Those are some examples.
Okay, thanks.
Also, can we go back to slide 18? This is kind of a side question, but just to understand the table.
Yeah.
So just looking at Angelo Gordon at the very top, and that was the inception was 2012. And oftentimes we have a sense that the fund will be going for 5 to 10 years or whatever, right? So it says on the remaining commitment side, that sounds like a pretty mature fund and should be ending. I guess we're just waiting for opportunities to exit. But remaining commitment, is that something that we have on the books that we still would be obligated to provide if they so called for that? Or is that just a number that, you know, or... is it real?
So that is, there's what's called recycling of capital. So when a manager returns capital during the investment period, they're usually allowed to recall that. So if they have an investment that pays off really quickly, they're still in their investment period, they send you the money back and say, but we might be able to recall this if we need it in the future. So it's a contingent liability. On a 2012 vintage fund, the likelihood of that capital being called is as close to zero as possible in this business. So if that was a 2018 vintage fund, I'd say, yeah, it could be recalled. It's kind of unlikely. But on a 2012 vintage fund, no, that's not going to get it. It's a contingent liability, but it's, in practical terms, it's not going to be exercised.
Great question.
And the reason why it's still on our list is because they still have assets that they have not fully exited from, right? We still have some skin in the game on that, and we're waiting for them to clean it up and finish it out, right?
They're down to, you know, the last few assets there. As happens with a lot of these funds, once you hit COVID, there wasn't a lot of activity, so funds get extended, but we're waiting for them to clean up those last few assets.
Okay. Thank you.
I also have a side question. On page 7, when you were talking about flight to newer properties, basically, in the office space, I just was wondering, what's wrong with 1980s? Is it just because even 60s are doing better than that? So what's any? Just if you know, I don't know.
We were talking about that before the meeting, and we're agreeing we needed to look into that. But we noticed that too, that the 80s, for whatever reason.
I think maybe that the architectural beauty of the buildings built in the 1980s was not that great.
I thought it was like shaggy carpets and wallpaper.
Yeah, so. Maybe stuff like that.
So I actually have insight into this because we've talked with some of the managers about this. Unfortunately, the 80s were right after the energy crisis of the 70s, which meant ceiling heights came down, windows were minimized, and they're just not attractive buildings. You don't have the ceiling height. You don't have the natural light. They were built for energy efficiency in an era where the building techniques hadn't caught up with energy efficiency, where if you go back to the 60s and 70s, you at least have higher ceilings, better windows, better natural light. So it was an unfortunate era in American or Western architecture. That was built to minimize the energy footprint, and unfortunately, there's not a lot you can do to reposition those buildings.
Did a lot for the automatic thermostat business, however. Yeah. That's a great question. Any other questions for the team?
Tim, any inflation impact? The 80s were probably the worst inflation in our era.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure there was, but what we've seen has been more the how the buildings were built for energy efficiency does not lend them to repositioning. That's been the bigger narrative. I think, you know, in terms of inflation and people building smaller buildings or lower quality buildings, that hasn't been the dominant theme. And a lot of those buildings just, you know, might have already gone by the wayside. But it is in talking with our managers, if you do not have a building built in 2014 or newer, you have a problem in your portfolio.
One other thing strikes me, and that is the 86 Tax Act. Prior to 86, reasonably high-income investors could effectively buy units and buildings or buy partnership interests and pay for it entirely through deductions against their otherwise taxable income. That ended in 86, but it meant there were a lot of see-through buildings.
Yeah. I think as we look around, the 80s were not a great time for design in America, let's put it that way, both from Detroit and from some of the architecture.
Any other questions of our team? Not seeing any. Thank you all. That was very interesting. Thank you.